It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania House and Senate return to session next week, and among the issues up for consideration is the hashtag MeToo Pennsylvania General Assembly Act. Senator Maria Collette from Montgomery County is the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 480, and Representative Leanne Krueger from Delaware County is the prime sponsor of House Bill 1000. I recently spoke with the two lawmakers. The hashtag MeToo movement sparked conversations about sexual assault and harassment across the country, and it caused many institutions to rethink their policies around sexual harassment. How can state government weigh in? Let's start with you, Senator, then Representative.
Sure. So thank you for the question. I think one of the things that we really saw when we saw the grand jury report that came out last week regarding Representative Ellis, one of the things that we saw is the failure for a reporting structure, a reporting mechanism. And that's the case in a lot of workplaces. And the failure to have an appropriate reporting mechanism for people that are being victimized means that their voices are often unheard. They are scared to step forward. And when we talk about our legislature, a place where we need to have the highest standards, and we don't even have that kind of reporting structure and mechanism in place, then what are we saying to businesses across the Commonwealth with regard to how they treat sexual harassment in the workplace?
And of course, that grand jury recommended an independent office be set up to investigate. Representative, your take on how state government can weigh in.
So we've been working for over 2 years now to reform the way that we handle sexual harassment complaints and investigations in Harrisburg. And in a report that Villanova released last week, they said that the General Assembly has not proven itself up to the task of conducting its own investigations and holding offenders accountable. We've now seen repeated instances of accusations of sexual harassment and even sexual assault against legislators, and we still have done nothing except for use taxpayer funds to study the problem. It is time for us to act. This latest grand jury report, the report that Villanova's Institute to Address Commercial Sex Exploitation released, all point to the same things. We need an independent review process with folks who are not elected officials deciding how to move these investigations forward. And the bill that the senator and I have worked on together gives us a clear solution to this problem.
Well, who should be doing the investigating? You mentioned the grand jury report, but also, what about the House Ethics Committee? Can we trust the legislature to investigate members of the body?
I've been in office 4 years now, and I've not seen one recommendation come from the House Ethics Committee. The Ethics Committee is made up of sitting legislators. It's a bipartisan group, and yet it is still elected officials deciding the outcomes for complaints against other elected officials. I believe that we need an independent body that is responsible for the investigation. One of the things that the report that came out in June showed was that there had been 544 instances of complaints, not all of them against legislators, some against staff. And they actually noted in the report that when a complaint is made against a House Republican member, it's up to the House Republican leader to decide how to handle that complaint. That needs to end. Victims need to know that their complaints will be handled with due process, that they will get the accountability and the transparency that they're looking for. And right now, we don't have that in Harrisburg. It's time for us to change the system.
Senator, could you give us a sense of the environment in state government? Do you feel safe from harassment?
You know, I have to say that that's a really touchy subject. I am a member of the caucus on the Democratic side of the aisle, and we have our own issue with regard to a current sitting legislator.
I believe you're referring to State Senator Dalen Leach. Am I not right?
That's correct.
All right.
You're absolutely correct. Myself and Senator Katie Muth, we have repeatedly asked for something to be done to keep this person that makes us feel unsafe in our own caucus room from being there. And unfortunately, as Representative Krueger stated, there isn't a mechanism. We file complaints with our ethics committee, with the Senate Ethics Committee. And unfortunately, again, it's left to the ethics committee and the leadership to decide whether or not they're going to hear those complaints, whether or not they're going to bring them forward to make a determination. And so we are standing on the steps of the Capitol talking about workplace harassment and the things that we need to do to protect other workers throughout the Commonwealth and throughout the United States. Yet in our own halls, we are unable to protect people that are there their jobs. And that is devastating. I've been in the legislature a short time. I don't have the experience that Representative Krueger has, but I can tell you that I am really proud to bring forth this piece of legislation because I think that this is going to start to address the problems that we have. Again, you know, having legislators decide whether or not they're going to bring forward complaints against other legislators to be heard actively and appropriately is just, you know, it's the inmates running the asylum. It is asking people who have been elected to office to make determinations about their colleagues who have been elected to office. In no other, business environment do we see that happening. We see that there are appropriate reporting structures and mechanisms, and yet in the own halls of our legislature, we're failing to do that for staff members and even for colleagues.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guests are Representative Leanne Krueger and Senator Maria Collette, sponsors of legislation to combat sexual harassment in state government. 11 other states have passed similar legislation in the last year. Are we lagging behind, Representative?
Absolutely. The bill that we're working on together was introduced last session as House Bill 1965. It was modeled after the bill that passed Congress with unanimous bipartisan support in the end, that would create an independent and clear process to address workplace sexual harassment complaints, specifically when they are made against sitting legislators. Washington got this done over a year ago, and House Bill 1965 last session got a hearing in the Labor Committee in September of 2018. There was no voiced opposition for the bill, only support from advocates, and in the end, it did not get a vote.
Representative, why did it not get a vote in your mind?
The majority chairman of the Labor Committee at the time, Representative Rob Kaufman, refused to bring the bill up for a vote, plain and simple.
There are bills in both chambers. Senator Collette, what do you consider to be a key provision for you in the legislation you sponsored?
Sure. Making sure that we have a mechanism in place that is outside of the legislative process, making sure that we have a voice for victims, a place for victims to file their complaints and have them brought forward and heard appropriately and investigated effectively without the influence or the oversight necessarily of a legislative committee and an elected body.
Representative Krueger, what do you consider to be key points in your legislation?
I believe that we need an independent investigator who is not responsible for getting anyone reelected to the legislature or to a leadership position. I believe that that person needs to have a background in these issues, and I believe that she or he need the resources responsible to conduct a clear and thorough investigation. In the bill that we've worked on together, the legislature would get a report of how many complaints against sexual harassment are made, and in the event that there is a finding that these allegations have teeth behind them, then I believe members of the public deserve a right to know who those legislators are. The report that came out in June showed that there's been $1.9 million in taxpayer-funded settlements against sexual harassment. That needs to end. No matter where you are in Pennsylvania, taxpayers don't want to be paying settlements for legislators who harass staff.
So who should be paying? Should it be the accused?
So in the bill that we've drafted together, in the end, if there is a finding and there is a settlement, that elected official is responsible for paying the taxpayers back. That's how we should handle this.
Senator, right now, say a lawmaker is accused of harassment and the allegations have merit. What happens next right now?
Well, unfortunately, what happens right now is the allegation goes to the Senate Ethics Committee and or the House Ethics Committee. And then again, there is a determination made whether or not to bring forward those complaints. Now, an individual has the opportunity to seek an outside law firm, for example, to bring forward a claim against the Senate if there's a failure to act. But that's really putting a heavy burden on the victim and making them go outside of the process that really could have a negative impact on their ability to find a firm, to seek redress if they have been wronged. And so unfortunately, claims are not made, or claims sort of go to the ethics committee to die and aren't brought forward to be heard.
Our guests on The Confluence are Senator Maria Collette and Representative Leanne Krueger. They're sponsors of legislation to combat sexual harassment in state government. Representative, what would your legislation do regarding non-disclosure agreements? What's the current status, and how would your legislation change that, if at all?
There have been a number of pieces of legislation regarding non-disclosure agreements, and there's actually one bill that passed the House Labor Committee earlier this year, sponsored by Representative Kate Klunk and Representative Morgan Cephas, that would ban the process of requiring non-disclosure agreements or requiring that victims sign them. That language was taken directly out of House Bill 1965 from last session, so that piece of the solution is starting to move in a bipartisan way. We just need to get it over the finish line in the Senate.
Would the elimination of non-disclosure agreements name the victims or just the perpetrators?
Just the perpetrators. You cannot release the name of the victim without their consent.
The previous legislation, Representative, that you referred to from last year did not come up for a vote, but a task force to investigate sexual harassment was established. What's the status of that task force?
Again, we have folks in Harrisburg, Republican leadership in Harrisburg, who are deciding to use taxpayer funds to set up studies and set up task force without actually taking real action. We know that there is a problem. It is clear that there is a problem, and we need to take real action to settle it. So I do not believe that the task force ever met or was even established in the first place.
Senator, are you concerned at all about having tied this to the hashtag MeToo movement, that it sticks the legislation to a social media movement, that the problem itself might get lost in the larger conversation?
You know, I have to say that I am really emboldened by the hashtag MeToo movement. And I think that what we're seeing is so many women and victims, men as well, step forward and finally say, I am a part of this movement. I am not afraid of linking it to the hashtag MeToo movement, because this is a movement that has legs. It has a voice. It has people really speaking and fighting back and standing up. And that's what this legislation needs. It needs to, have its opportunity to come forward, be heard, for us to have votes on this legislation so that we can move it through the House and through the Senate and get it to the governor's desk for a signature so that we can implement solutions.
Representative Krueger, what's your take on that?
I believe that women have come forward in Pennsylvania and felt the support that they needed to file complaints because of the Me Too movement. They realized that they weren't alone. My work on this issue started when I first saw the Me Too hashtag starting a couple years ago and shared my own story of having been sexually harassed by a college professor when I was an undergraduate. That led women in the Capitol to reach out to me and tell me their own stories. And the stories that we've heard publicly are only the tip of the iceberg. I believe that there are many more women who've been harassed who have not felt comfortable coming forward, because when complaints are filed, nothing seems to happen. And even in the allegations of rape against Brian Ellis, we have a grand jury who's decided not to press charges or not to recommend charges. People need to feel like they will be heard, and if they are victimized, that we will come together and we will have their backs in the process. That is not happening now, but I do believe that if we change the process in Harrisburg, if we change the system, if we create an independent review body that does not have to answer to elected officials, who is able to really investigate the truth and then report what they find, I believe that will change the culture.
Who would this apply to? Just lawmakers and their staffs, executive branch, all state employees?
The bill that we've introduced is specific to how we handle complaints against legislators, but there are many, many recommendations for how we handle complaints against other staff, too. Of the 544 complaints that have been filed in the past 5 years, many more of them are against employees than are legislators. But there's because there is a different process when a complaint is filed against a legislator, we need to deal with that first. That's where most most of the concerns have been lately. And we need victims to have a really clear way to move forward.
So what's the prognosis this time for the legislation? I believe both bills have been in committee since this spring. Senator Collette, let's start with you.
So I'm going to say unequivocally that I'm not going to stop fighting and pushing to get support for this bill and to have it heard in committee and then brought to the floor for a vote. I think that we have a really good opportunity with everything that's happening, like you said, the hashtag MeToo movement, but also because there is so much critical thought and voice around making sure that victims have an opportunity and that we aren't silencing people who are being wronged in their workplace. So I am optimistic that we will have the opportunity to move forward with this and that we will ultimately get one of these bills to the governor's desk for a signature.
And Representative Krueger.
There's a new chair of the State Government Committee where House Bill 1000 has been referred this session. That's Garth Everett, and he did tell the press earlier this summer that he plans to hold hearings on this topic when we come back in September. We need to make sure that House Bill 1000 is on the agenda at that hearing, that it has a fair hearing again and actually gets a vote, and that we've got a chance to move this forward. I fundamentally agree with the statement made in the Villanova report that elected officials should be held to a higher standard of conduct than private citizens. And getting a vote in committee and ultimately on the floor in House Bill 1000 gives us the opportunity to hold elected officials accountable.
Representative Leanne Krueger is from Delaware County. Senator Maria Collette is from Montgomery County. Thanks to both of you for taking the time today.
Thanks so much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Landfill runoff from the oil and gas industry containing toxic materials might be the fault of a loophole in regulations. And the state is set to close the Polk Center for Adults with Intellectual Disabilities in Venango County, but the families of some residents say their loved ones aren't ready to leave. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the excursion steamer named Island Queen explodes while docked along the Monongahela Wharf in 1947. The Cincinnati-based boat required a minor repair, which its chief engineer figured could be solved by welding. But the hot metal sparked a fire through the boat and onto the fuel tank, causing a massive explosion. 19 crew members died, and cars on the wharf caught fire. People crowded to the area to watch the aftermath, and the story has since become part of Pittsburgh lore. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Flu season is around the corner. Last year, 28 people in Allegheny County died from complications of the virus. Getting vaccinated is one of the best ways to protect yourself and loved ones from the flu.
I get one every year because of my age and my health conditions. I need to take it.
Yeah, so.
My doctor's demanded I take it, so I get it.
Mine too.
He demands it.
Yeah. I've been doing it every year since I was a kid, I guess. I can't say I've ever had the flu.
I've worked in the healthcare field for many years. I know how important it is to just not only keep myself healthy, but my patients that I might be working around. So that's why I always get my flu shot done.
That was Cherry Smith and Brenda Fuller of Homewood, Ryan Bustamante of East Liberty, and East End resident Nichelle Llewellyn. For our Moment of Science series, 90.5 WESA health reporter Sarah Bowden spoke with Dr. Mark Iskowitz, who specializes in internal and preventive medicine. He says when a large number of people are immune to a virus through vaccination, the less likely it is for that virus to spread to medically vulnerable people, a concept called herd immunity.
We know that within a population, there will be a subset of patients who either cannot or will not get vaccinated. However, they can continue to be protected if a percentage of the overall population has been vaccinated. Traditionally, we talk about 90% on average with most viruses as being that target goal to provide a level of herd immunity whereby, for example, very young patients or very old patients may be protected even if they are not themselves vaccinated.
And is the threshold for influenza roughly 90%?
That is a number that's been described. Obviously, the higher, the better to provide herd immunity. The reality in the United States is that only about 35 to 40% of the population year to year is vaccinated against the flu. So we never even approach a number like that. We take the concept of herd immunity from other conditions, especially measles, which is the most known contagious virus, and we see that a 90% or even 95% level of immunity provides sufficient herd immunity. Now, within a family unit, if you can vaccinate, for example, 4 out of 5 members, that is likely going to be sufficient. That would be technically 80%, but will likely provide a level of protection in someone who may not be able to get the vaccine.
So that's why everyone should get the vaccine, is what you're saying, essentially, even if your immune system is hardy enough that you could withstand being sick with the flu. Not everyone is that healthy.
That's correct. People decline the flu vaccine for various reasons. One of the reasons people give is, I don't usually get sick, but it is important to think about the people around you at work or at home, especially the more vulnerable members of our society, medically vulnerable, which are the very young and the very old. In any given patient, they may be at higher risk based on their immune system or other medical factors that they may have. So when the patient gets vaccinated, they not only protect themselves, but the people in their environment.
So if you want to see your grandparents around the holidays or meet your friend's new baby, you should probably get the vaccine, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. We definitely recommend 6 months of an age and older. Everyone should get vaccinated. Remember that you are going to come into contact with a lot of people throughout flu season. Flu season starts as early as November. Last year, we had a very active March, and even April, there were a number of cases here in Western Pennsylvania. And so it's unlikely you are going to be isolated from the sick population for a period of months. The best way to protect yourself is a combination of vaccination and good hygiene. Keep in mind that if you get the flu, having already been vaccinated, your chances of having a severe illness are significantly decreased. So those patients that go to the hospital and develop pneumonia and sometimes even die from the flu are generally much less likely to have been vaccinated. So you are protecting yourself, you're protecting the community when you get the flu vaccine.
That was Dr. Mark Iskowitz of Allegheny Health Network speaking with WESA's Sarah Bowden. Find more from our Moment of Science series at our website, WESA.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Landfills in many states are allowed to accept solid waste from the oil and gas industry. When it rains, chemicals, toxic metals, and radioactive material in that waste become part of the landfill's runoff. That runoff is supposed to be treated before it's sent to a sewage plant. But earlier this year, some of these pollutants started ending up in water released by a sewage treatment plant near Pittsburgh. How did they get there? For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found a loophole in state and federal regulations might be to blame.
Guy Krupa is walking down a driveway near the main road in the town of Belle Vernon.
There's the sewage treatment facility right there.
Krupa is in charge of the treatment plant, a small facility along the Monongahela River that processes sewage from a few surrounding towns.
I mean, it's just a bunch of tanks with, microbiological bugs in it.
The bugs are microorganisms the plant uses to break down raw sewage before it's treated and released into the river. But about a year and a half ago, those bugs stopped doing their job. Levels of bacteria and ammonia in the plant's discharge to the river started going up.
We thought it was something we were doing internally. We were not processing enough sludge. Maybe we weren't pumping enough. Maybe we had wrong air rates, things like that. We went through the whole gamut of things.
Krupa, who'd only recently started his job as the municipal authority's superintendent, thought about all the places that send waste to the plant.
We take in Belle Vernon and North Belle Vernon, but we also take in a landfill.
That would be Westmoreland Sanitary Landfill, about a mile away in the town of Rostraver. For years, the landfill sent Belle Vernon its leachate. That's the name for the liquid waste that comes out of the landfill when rainwater trickles through its piles of garbage. Krupa began looking at test samples of what was in the leachate. He sent it to an engineer he used to work with.
He goes, you have some very high numbers as far as chlorides, conductivity, barium, He said, these are all indicators of frack waste.
Krupa discovered the landfill was sending more leachate than the treatment plant was allowed to accept. And he found out about 40% of the landfill's waste since 2010 had been solid oil and gas waste. This waste includes drill cuttings, dirt, and rocks companies dig up to get to the region's gas-rich shale beds. Those beds are naturally rich in salt. It turned out the salts in the leachate were hurting the bugs in Krupa's sewage system.
They were killing off our bugs. Our bugs are what treats the water. They were killing them. And that's why we weren't making our permit levels, because we had nothing to work with.
It wasn't just the salts, Krupa says. Gas waste is high in radium, a naturally occurring radioactive material found in the Marcellus Shale. Some of that radium was making it from the Westmoreland landfill through Krupa's treatment plant and into the Monongahela River.
We were discharging into the Mon River higher than drinking water standards.
Still, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection told Krupa to keep taking the leachate while it got the landfill to fix the problem. The DEP says what the plant was putting into the river was actually safe. They say that by the time that radium or other pollutants discharged by the plant end up at the nearest drinking water supply, it's been diluted by the river's high volume. But that explanation didn't exactly sit well with the man in charge of that drinking water plant.
Yeah, it was alarming, to say the least.
Chad Warfield is director of operations at the Charleroi Water Authority, which provides drinking water to around 30,000 people. When Warfield learned what was coming down the river from Belle Vernon, he ordered his staff to test the water in nearby streams. But he wasn't sure if he was testing for the right thing.
The problem was, you know, nobody knows what's exactly in the leachate.
Charleroi's water quality continued to meet federal standards, but Warfield said he was still worried.
It's, you know, frightening, to be blunt, that it went on that long and, you know, they were experiencing those issues and it, you know, and it was let go.
Eventually, Belle Vernon got tired of waiting for the DEP and the landfill to fix the problem. The municipal authority that owns the plant went to court and got a judge to order the landfill to stop sending its leachate to the plant. Currently, the landfill's trucking that leachate to treatment plants in Ohio. But the case raises a question. Are other landfills and treatment plants at risk? The DEP says no. No one from the agency agreed to go on tape for this story. But in emails, a spokeswoman said Belle Vernon's case was unique. There are 16 other treatment plants in the state that take leachate from landfills that accept fracking waste. These landfills are required to pre-treat that leachate to make it safe for the sewage plant. But that's only in the case of bigger sewage plants that handle 5 million gallons a day or more. For smaller ones, like Belle Vernon's, the law is less clear. In these cases, the treatment plants themselves are required to know of any changes to the waste they receive from a landfill. Krupa says he learned of this soft spot in the law when he told a DEP official that the landfill's waste was affecting his plant.
He said, well, that you are the entity that would be responsible for that. I said, so there's nothing you could do for me? And he said, no, you are the DEP to them, essentially.
The problem is, the landfill has no obligations under state or federal law to tell the treatment plant about changes to its waste stream. So even though the state knew the landfill was taking drilling waste, Krupa says no one told him or anyone at his plant. Krupa is mystified by what happened.
What they are sending us was industrial waste. Those things need to be treated differently.
There are other plants that could find themselves in a similar situation to Belle Vernon's. According to a review of state pollution permits, 12 other smaller plants fit into the same category as Belle Vernon. They're too small to automatically qualify for stricter regulations on leachate and have to police the landfills themselves. For this story, the DEP couldn't immediately say whether those landfills were pre-treating their leachate or not. The state insists no one was endangered by the leachate issues in Belle Vernon. Its water quality monitors along the Monongahela River were all below the EPA standards for radiation. But Avner Vengosh of Duke University says he sees real problems with the state's practices.
They never learned anything through the last 10 years.
Vengosh is an environmental chemist who's measured pollutant levels in the stream sediment near treatment plants in Pennsylvania that process liquid oil and gas waste. He found radium levels in some sediments high enough to qualify as radioactive waste under federal law. He wonders if the same type of accumulation could be happening in the river near Belle Vernon.
The radioactivity level could be really high if you collect the sediments there. And of course, the risk is that once there's high radium in the sediments, there is incorporation into the ecological chain.
A spokeswoman for the landfill didn't answer emailed questions or agree to an interview for this story. The DEP says it's working on installing a pretreatment system to handle the site's leachate. The landfill is currently negotiating with another sewage plant to take its waste. That plant is in Denora, just 5 miles downstream of Belle Vernon. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Department of Human Services has announced it plans to close 2 of the 4 state-run centers for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including the Polk State Center in Venango County. Reporter Kate Giamarisi of the Post-Gazette has been investigating what this means to the residents, their families, and the community. She joins us in studio. Kate, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a little background, if you would. Where is the Polk Center? How long has it been around?
So Polk is located about 90 minutes or so north of here. It is in Venango County. It's in an area that's pretty rural. It actually opened its doors in 1897, so it's been around quite some time.
It's one of the older ones, if not the oldest?
I believe it is the oldest state-run facility in Pennsylvania for folks with intellectual disabilities.
At one time, they had many, many residents. So about how many residents now?
Well, so at its height, Polk probably had more than about 3,000 people. I believe that was in the 1950s or 60s, but that was a very different era, and there's about 194 residents there now. It's located near some small towns in Venango County. You know, it's sort of almost feels a little bit like a college campus, with its sort of old brick buildings and you know, fields and greenery around it.
Mm-hmm. Like a giant building where everybody has a room, or there are separate buildings, different homes, if you would, for the residents?
Well, so I think it depends on sort of people's levels of need. I mean, it is really like a campus in that there's a lot of different buildings. There's an administration building and there's residential buildings. You know, there's a pool and a different sort of workshop areas. People sort of have different setups, I think, based on kind of their level of medical need.
Right. How long have some of the residents been at Polk? As you visited the place, what did you learn about the residents in terms of their longevity there?
Many of the residents have lived there for many decades.
Decades.
Yeah. And many of them are also very elderly. So for them, this is their home, and that's how their family members see it as well, that Polk is their home. So that's why they see this as it could be a very difficult transition or adjustment to a smaller, you know, group home type facility, which is where the state, you know, proposes to move people to.
So, Kate, what is at the heart of the decision by the State Department of Human Services? Is it strictly a cost-cutting measure or some other reason?
Basically, for many decades, Pennsylvania and other states have been moving away from these large types of institutions, in part because, you know, historically they were the sites of some pretty bad abuses, and because there's been a lot of legal decisions and sort of social movements and a lot of research that shows that people really don't do as well living in these types of settings. They do better living in smaller community settings, like a smaller privately run group home, or in some cases at home with their families. There is a savings to the state because it's a very expensive place to operate, but the state has really emphasized that that's not the main driver of their decision.
The group homes, they are smaller. Are they also regulated, though, by the state, DHS?
Yes, they definitely are.
Mm-hmm. Post-Gazette reporter Kate Giamarisi is our guest on The Confluence. We're talking about the state's announcement that it will close the Polk Center for Adults with Intellectual Disabilities. Kate, Polk was at the center of controversy for abuse of residents, especially in the 70s, but that apparently continued for some years. What did you learn as you were reporting this piece about the closure?
Well, you know, I want to emphasize that there, no one is saying that kind of thing happens there anymore. But when you read the history of Polk and these other similar types of institutions, there is definitely some pretty dark things about how people were treated there, which is, you know, I think part of why we as a society basically decide to move away from this type of facility.
In doing your research, you found that some family members of the residents and disability advocacy groups are actually on opposite sides of this issue. Close it, keep it open. What did the advocacy groups say?
Well, you know, they really emphasize that people can have a better quality of life in a smaller group home type setting. Even though family members are very resistant to that, they've really said that, you know, in the past, in closing other group homes, that people have been happy with their decision and with where their family member has ended up. But a lot of family members counter that their loved one has been living at Polk for a very long time. They have very serious needs in terms of, you know, perhaps care and supervision. A lot of these individuals who live there who are very elderly, like I said, they've lived there the better part of their lives, and some of them live there from when they were children. So it is a very emotional issue. Disruption was a word that I heard a lot.
What about the economic impact? It costs a lot of money to run a center, loads of employees. That could impact workers and also impact the community that benefits from having this major employer in that area?
So that was certainly a concern I heard a lot in Venango County from their local elected officials, that this facility employs more than 700 people. And many of those individuals are unionized, and those are, you know, what most people would consider to be good paying jobs. So it's a major employer in that region. So that's very much a concern of folks there.
And this approach to closing institutions, this is happening elsewhere as well?
Yes, some states don't have any institutions any longer at all. And Pennsylvania has closed, you know, many institutions over the years. And with this announcement a few weeks ago that they intend to close two more state centers, there would only be two centers left in the entire state.
You talked with workers for your story. Are they concerned about their jobs or their residents, or let's face it, both?
Yeah, they definitely raised the issue of both, that, you know, they were concerned for their jobs, but also that, you know, the one woman whose voice is featured pretty prominently in the story, she's worked at Polk for 9 years, and she feels very close with her residents that she cares for and feels like they're her family. And in some instances, the individuals that she cares for can't communicate verbally. And, you know, so she knows them. She knows their needs, and she just feels very concerned that they're not going to get the level of care that they would elsewhere.
At this point, are you hearing any talk, any rumbling that there could be legal action to keep Polk open?
So I'm not aware of any lawsuit in this instance, but that is certainly not unusual when the state closes institutions, that employees and some elected officials and family members fight to keep it open. That's more common than not.
This is meant to be a 3-year process to close. What are some of the questions? What are some of the aspects that you'll want to continue to follow?
So, yeah, it's something that is not going to happen overnight. And the state has emphasized that they will not force people to move without, you know, first, of course, finding them an appropriate home. They've also said that the folks who work there will be offered other state employment if they wish it. So while the state has really firmly emphasized that it is their intention to close the center, you know, they have said it is going to be a lengthy process over 3 years.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Kate Giamarisi, thanks so much for your good work.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Pittsburgh is just the 4th region in the world to be designated as a United Nations Center of Excellence on High-Performance Buildings because of its commitment to built sustainability. We'll speak with UN's head of sustainability, Scott Foster. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.